Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Democrats in the State House have introduced a package of bills to add more state regulations to this process. We'll speak with a co-sponsor of the legislation on today's program. And as the use of meth makes headlines across the state, we talked to one woman about her recovery and what she's doing for other addicts. But first, the debate over expanding Medicaid in Michigan continues. Governor Snyder is still pushing for the state Senate to go ahead and vote on the legislation. It would expand Medicaid to hundreds of thousands of low-income adults in Michigan. The state House has already approved it. Well, over the weekend, Mark Schauer jumped into the debate. Schauer, a Democrat, is running for governor in 2014. Here he is from Saturday.
What I would do is call the legislature immediately into a special session. He has the constitutional authority specifically to pass Medicaid expansion. I, for the life of me, can't figure out why he's not doing it.
Well, let's try to answer that very question as we bring in Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Mark Schauer, we're here to help you.
Well, Mark Schauer is saying, hey, Governor, get tough. Call back that state Senate if you want them to so badly pass this expansion. So can he do that?
The answer is an absolute.
Resolute.
Definitive. We just don't know.
But here is what we do know, Cindy. Rick?
Okay. Everybody turn to Article 5, Section 15 of your Michigan Constitution. It's on page 21 of my copy. I don't know about yours. I will read it now in its entirety. The governor may convene the legislature on extraordinary occasions.
And that's it.
And the question is, you know, what does that mean? What's an extraordinary occasion? Now this power used to be used fairly regularly when we didn't have a year-round legislature that meets from January through the end of December. Pretty typically, back in the day, the legislature would be wrapped up well by now and gone until next year.
Right. And if some business cropped up that needed tending to, the governor would just call the legislature back. It doesn't happen anymore, though, because the legislature's just never gone for that long, Cindy.
They're always there. So, Rick, when is the last time a governor called back the legislature?
Well, the last time a governor tried was in 1988. It was a continuation of the political feud between Governor Jim Blanchard, a Democrat, and the Republican State Senate Majority Leader, John Engler. And this time they were fighting over home heating assistance, prescription help for seniors, and repealing the state's inheritance tax. Blanchard threatened to call the legislature back after they had taken a recess, and it was a standoff that was actually settled before it came to calling a special session.
So, Rick, what's the confusion here then?
Well, the confusion, the unsettled question, is whether the governor can actually call a special session while the legislature is still technically in its regular session. Uh-huh. Right now, the legislature is just on a summer recess. The session isn't over until December. There's even a pro forma meeting day this week. It's a just-in-case day, but nothing will happen, no roll calls, no attendance, hardly anyone will show up. Or can the governor call the legislature back to vote on something anytime the legislature leaves town? We just don't know. There are smart opinions on both sides of this question, and a lot of people who are saying it's all really just a big muddle.
And that's what makes this so fun for us political watchers, Cindy, because we've been on the phone, really smart people who have an idea of how it absolutely is. Uh-huh. And then you talk to someone else who has an idea of the opposite idea of how it actually is. This is what makes it all so fascinating.
Well, Zoe, why is Schauer jumping into this now with both feet?
Well, I mean, it's what you do, right? I mean, Schauer gets to say, hey, if I was in power, this is what I would do. This is what the governor should be doing. You know, it's his opportunity to take any chance he can get to show what his leadership would look like. It's, of course, a lot easier to say what you would do than actually have to be the one to do it.
Right. And Mark Schauer gets to do all that without having to deal with the responsibility or the fallout of that action. I mean, let's assume Rick Snyder could call the legislature back. A big if, but still, is that a good idea? He can't make them vote, let alone vote yes on the Medicaid expansion. So would he just be needlessly antagonizing legislators when he's looking for them to vote with him anyway?
Particularly as you're looking forward with negotiations that are going to be happening, he's going to want votes probably on road funding and things like that.
Well, we should note it isn't just Schauer versus Snyder, Democrats versus Republicans. What is at the heart of this intra-party fight within the GOP? Right.
Yeah. And again, I mean, that's what makes this so interesting. You have some members of the Republican Party, including Governor Snyder, saying you've got to do this. You know, it's going to save the state money in the long run. It's important to do for people who are low income to expand Medicaid. But then you have really conservative Republicans who just aren't buying it. They don't believe.
Tea partiers.
They don't believe the federal government will hold up their end of the bargain, which is to fully fund the expansion for its first couple of years. It's, you know, important to note, though, that all of this also isn't happening in a vacuum. Of course, the entire state house, the entire state senate, Governor Snyder, all up for re-election in November 2014. So everyone is being really, really cautious on how they vote on something that's so controversial.
And there's also a pretty interesting dynamic here, too, Rick. The fact is Democrats probably need to be careful what they wish for.
Well, yeah, this is one of those cases when you talk about the governor calling back the legislature, that this is an interaction between two separate, independent, equal branches of government. And so let's say and they tend to be, you know, they tend to, you know, jealously guard their prerogatives. So let's just look at the Democrats. Let's say the Democrats take over the legislature in 2014. The state house is a somewhat more likely prospect than the state Senate. And Governor Snyder wins re-election. Also turn that around. Republicans retain control, but Mark Schauer wins election. If you are a legislator, are you really going to want a governor of the opposite party to have this power, the power to call back lawmakers to session whenever they leave, the minute they leave, and he just doesn't want them to?
It's interesting to note, Cindy, too, we're seeing something sort of like this right now in the U.S. Senate over the filibuster rule, right? That when you're in the majority, it's much easier to want to pass something. When you're in the minority, maybe you want it passed. And then the second it switches, suddenly it's be careful what you wish for.
You just might get it. Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark are It's Just Politics team. They bring us It's Just Politics. Find out more. Go to It's Just Politics at Michigan Radio. Thanks, guys.
You bet.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
If you, like me, are not a fan of hot weather, this is not a week we're going to enjoy. Temps will be in the 90s, and the high humidity means it's going to feel like it's over 100 all week long through Michigan. Weather and public health experts tell us we in Michigan had better get used to heat waves like this because this is our future. And that is raising health concerns. The current issue of Our Detroit has a story that looks at what those concerns are. It's called Warning on Warming. And writer Eileen Wolf joins us here in the studio. Eileen, how likely is it that we in Michigan are going to have to acclimate our hearts and lungs to the kind of heat we're feeling this week?
Oh, I think it's already here, and I think it's probably only going to get worse. It'll be more important for us to acclimate ourselves. If you look at a map on EPA.gov, you'll see that under the best case scenario, Michigan summers will be like those in Missouri and Arkansas. Under the worst case scenario, they'll be like the summers in Texas and Oklahoma.
So let's talk, Eileen, about what this means in terms of health challenges. So what will our kids and our grandkids have to deal with?
Well, as my article says, I think we have to look at three different factors. One is insect-borne diseases, what the public health community calls vector-borne diseases, and that could be West Nile virus, which, of course, we've already contended with, and things like dengue fever, which had an outbreak in Florida a few years back. The second thing I think we need to worry about is pollution, both particle pollution and ozone pollution. And unfortunately, the most recent research has shown that particle pollution can actually cause the onset of asthma. The third thing that we have to worry about is weather, like, you know, heat, storms, mm-hmm. severe storms, which we're seeing here in Michigan. We saw Hurricane Katrina. We saw Hurricane Sandy. And in addition to the storms, we would be contending with flooding, displacement from our homes, like we saw in Grand Rapids mm-hmm. earlier.
Yes, yes, we did.
And things of that nature.
So what should be on the climate change to-do list for state and county health officials?
Have a plan. Put a plan in place. Learn from other communities. Look at their benchmarks and put a plan of your own in place.
And for us individually, besides just complaining about the weather?
Well, I think there are a lot of things people can do. I'm a big proponent of keeping yourself healthy so that you don't have to take a lot of medicines or have high health bills. Of course, that's not always going to work, but why not sort of buy that kind of insurance? And I'm showing quote marks with my fingers. Why not buy that kind of insurance so that you can withstand these kinds of conditions? The better condition your heart is, the better condition your lungs are in, the more the chances are that you're going to be able to withstand those kind of heat stresses.
Either that or you move to the Northwest Territories and hope that it doesn't get
but
up there.
If you love Michigan, here we
right.
are. And I love Michigan.
I know what you mean. Eileen Wolfe's piece in Our Detroit magazine is called Warning on Warming. It is in the current issue of Our Detroit. And she joined us in the studio. Thank you so much, Eileen Wolfe.
Cindy, thank you for having me.
Come, new proposals in Lansing would further regulate fracking in Michigan. Democrats in the State House are worried that the process for extracting natural gas could lead to environmental problems in the state. We'll find out more in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent news story out of West Michigan caught our eye. Three of the five men linked to the biggest meth bust in Michigan have been sentenced to federal prison. It all began with a traffic stop in Pawpaw, and that led police to discover more than 20 pounds of pure methamphetamine from the vehicle and from a pole barn in Van Buren County. U.S. Homeland Security believes methamphetamine is being smuggled into the country in hidden compartments of vehicles and then sold in West Michigan. And crime reports find southwest Michigan counties top the state list for meth lab busts, while burns from explosions and spills from cooking meth are on the rise in Kalamazoo County, and meth cases crowd court dockets in southwest Michigan. We wanted to shed more light on methamphetamine, and our next guest can bring us this story in an intensely personal way. Jen Servey founded the Collegiate Recovery Program while she was a student at the University of Michigan. Today, she's a substance abuse coordinator at the Michigan Ability Partners in Ann Arbor and is soon heading to Texas to continue work with the Collegiate Recovery Program. Most importantly, Jen Servey is a recovering meth addict. She has been sober since May 13th, 2006, and she joins us here in the studio. Welcome to the program, and I see your face kind of smile when I say that day. That was your new life, May 13th, 2006?
That was. That was my ultimate surrender to the disease and the day of my new awakening.
And here you are working to help people from going down the path that you followed. Tell us when meth first entered your life.
Well, it was late 1998, so that would make me, what, about 26 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I had tried other drugs in the past. You know, I have a history of opiate usage. I've had tried alcohol early in my undergraduate years. I had some marijuana usage and had been able to put down all other drugs when they stopped kind of working for me or had some consequences from their usage. However, when the first time I tried methamphetamines, there was something completely different about it. The first time I ever tried methamphetamines, my brain literally lit up, and I knew that I never wanted to be sober again.
It was a different feeling than anything you'd felt.
It was.
Who gave it to you? How did it enter your life?
You know, interestingly, I had a friend that was working at a county jail there down there in Texas, you know, which kind of shows you the normalcy of the usage down there. She brought it over one night. I said no the first time she offered it. Second time she offered it, I did it. And I absolutely never wanted to sleep again.
Why?
I was one of those kids growing up that, like, I absolutely loved my life. Like, I never, it wasn't that I used drugs to escape life. I used drugs to enhance my life. I had a hard time early on balancing, like, alcohol usage and my academic studies and the demands of my friends. So the first time I did meth, I thought, you know what? I can balance everything and never have to sleep again.
Is your thinking still clear, or what does it do to just the way you operate throughout the day while you're high on meth?
Well, the thing about it is as an individual, you think that your thinking is clear. But when the body stays up 8 and 9 days at a time, it can't possibly be functioning normally. The body needs to sleep at the end of the day. The body needs to eat, and it takes everything in your power to even sit down and have a meal. So when I was going 8 days at a time without sleep, maybe eating one meal a day, and usually those meals were based upon high sugar content, dehydration from not intaking many fluids, you know, surviving in Texas heat of like 100 degrees, my body wasn't functioning normally.
And were you going to school at the time? What were you supposed to be doing in your life at that time?
I was. I was completing, supposedly, the end of my bachelor's degree in sociology at Texas Women's University.
Wow. And how did that go?
Well, I, at the time, basically stopped going to classes because I thought that I was done. Simultaneously, my mother was getting, she had rheumatoid arthritis and was getting increasingly ill. And my family began to start calling me on a regular basis saying I needed to come home. And I stopped answering the phone. Mm. Yeah.
So what was the progression, Jen, as you were using? How long did you use?
I used until 2006.
So what led to that crash where you said, I have to stop? Because you did go to jail and prison, didn't you?
For sure. So I had many interventions. My first one came in 1999. Quickly, I got my first possession case. So immediately, I had the court system. I was drug screening for the court system 3 times a week. During that time period, I was still using and trying to fake out the court system, knowing that I would probably go to jail. I did a small time in jail on that one. I went to my first treatment center. Did a 30-day treatment center during that time period, and it did not get any better. My mother passed away in December of 1999. I spoke at her funeral. Hi. I was on her bedside here in Michigan at Beaumont Hospital. Hi. And those consequences were not enough to make anything change. In fact, at that point, that was a tipping point that led me all the way into addiction, where I had the thought process of, if your mother died, you would use too. And during that time period, I caught 5 felony charges, all for possession of methamphetamines under a gram within the state of Texas in 4 different counties.
So you were leaving quite a wake of legal trouble in your in your trail. And who were your friends? Who were the people in your life?
So my ultimate goal was to become the functional drug addict. So I led a double life. I had the people that supported my drug habits. I had my father that was an enabler who supplied all the funding for this. I had also this other life of people who were like my bosses, my employers, because I was trying to go to work every day. And who knew nothing about my drug habits, except that the accidental, random, oh my gosh, I ended up in jail again.
Boy, I'm talking with Jen Servey, who today is with Michigan Ability Partners. She also founded the Collegiate Recovery Program while she was a student at the University of Michigan, sharing her experience of being a methamphetamine addict for many, many years. And it was not until May 13th, 2006 that she stopped using. So having begun in 98 and going to 2006, you had such a long stretch. And I suspect now that you've gone through the tunnel and you look back, you realize you're very lucky to be sitting here talking with us today.
I am.
Your father, you just said, was an enabler.
He was.
What did your father do? Your mother passed away in 99. So as you went through these years of meth addiction, what did your dad do that was wrong?
He understood nothing about addiction. And, you know, today he still struggles, I think, with a little bit about what recovery means. He could not stand to see his daughter incarcerated. You know, and I think he felt very helpless, and I think he felt very alone. And so you know, he did a lot of things to orchestrate and manipulate, like move everything that I owned up to Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in order to thinking that that would control me and move me back up to Michigan. And all it did was it sent me to treatment here at Brighton Hospital. And I moved right back down and did everything under my terms.
Right back to Texas.
Yes. I moved exactly where to my source of my drugs were. I took my car, I took my dog, and I took $200. And I moved right back to Texas. And within 8 months, I was incarcerated for the last time. The thing that he finally did right was he listened to my attorneys that were also my bondsmen, and the very last time they said, "You leave her there."
He did.
I no longer had a bond. May 13th of 2006, I was arrested in a very small county of Palo Pinto County, Texas, and I had four charges out of four counties, and had just received my fifth. And I called, and he said, "No, I will not leave you there."
And that was the first time you heard that.
Yes. And the door slammed for the very last time.
So what did it take then? There's that date, May 13th, 2006. You had to own your illness. How did that happen?
I was on a payphone with my father in a really small county jail. And I said to him, "Fine, I'm an addict." And for the first time in my life, I heard my voice reverberate off the jail cell walls. And I believed it. And I stood up. And for anybody that's ever been in a county jail, they have this module that's like the toilet and the sink, and it's all together. And I stood up on the little toilet, and I looked in this little funhouse mirror, and my eyes no longer had a soul. And see, all this time I had always thought that I couldn't possibly be an addict because I thought I was a college graduate, which I later found out I wasn't because I stopped going to classes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you get a degree. But I thought that I was a college graduate from a really good family, and that these kind of things don't happen to somebody like me, that they only happen on TV. And the thing about it was they do. And for the first time in my life, when I saw the reflection of myself and I heard my voice say those words, I surrendered. And that's the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous.
And that was that all it took? Did you ever backslide? Did you ever use again? Or was that the end for you?
That was my moment of clarity.
And now you finally did graduate.
I did. I finally have completed my degree at a local university. But it wasn't until I applied here at U of M to the Master's of Social Work program that I even figured out I didn't even have a bachelor's degree. Mm. I finished a bachelor's degree. I completed an associate's degree. And then I came here to U of M to the social work program.
And in setting up the collegiate recovery program and working with Michigan Ability Partners, and now you're heading back to Texas to again, help people from going down your path. Explain why Southwest Michigan is the area with the most meth activity. We don't see as much meth activity as far as meth labs, and the court cases seem to be really concentrated in Southwest Michigan. What is it about producing meth that makes that happen?
Well, my feelings is, and this is just my opinion, mm-hmm. is that, for example, in Texas, the reason why meth became so popular in Texas is because it's really easy to produce methamphetamines in an area that's in a rural area. Meth smells really strongly when you produce it. It takes a lot of farming chemicals to make it. Mm. The government has really closed down on a lot of the amphetamines that you take to purchase to make it. You can't just make methamphetamines necessarily in the middle of your neighborhood. I mean, you can, but for example, when I was living in downtown Fort Worth, the kid across the street from me tried to make it in his house, and he blew up the next door neighbor's house. So when you try to do these things, more than likely, you're going to end up getting caught. It's really easy to make it in the middle of a farmhouse because the chances are the DEA is not going to come like looking for you, and the next door neighbors aren't going to know what they're even smelling.
So, in fact, we were talking about the television program Breaking Bad, which is going into its final season. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of Americans who've watched that show had their eyes open, and you said you found it incredibly authentic.
It was very authentic. I mean, it was authentic down to the production, the way it was produced, the glassware that was made. I mean, to my experience, and I was thrown right in the middle of it. I mean, some of the experiences that I had in my last year out using scared me, but not scared me enough to be sober. I mean, and that was the point when I knew that I was in, and I had lost sight of being a functional addict, and I knew that I could go to prison for a really long time. And I didn't know how to stop using, because the insidiousness of meth usage, meth tells you if you, it was telling me every single morning, if I didn't get high that day, I was going to die.
Which is something you never got from marijuana or from alcohol or pills.
No. And it tells you that you can be so functional and so productive and get so much accomplished on it. And I think that that's why it really appeals to the college age student. Because it shows you that you can get so much classwork done. You can study for hours, and you can be so academically successful. So it appeals to the students who have all these academic pressures on them, and to be the best and to achieve so much on a college campus.
How do you, Jen, as a counselor, as someone who works or tries to keep kids from going down the path you went on, how do you, from the outside, get them to where you were internally when you looked in that mirror in that county jail in Texas and saw you didn't have any soul left in your eyes? How do you get them there?
I can, number one, share my experience, strength, and hope. You know, a lot of what we've done with collegiate recovery is be able to form a community. Because, let's face it, university campuses are a place where it is the social acceptance and the social norm to use alcohol, to use marijuana, to use things like Adderall to be academically successful. So how do we show these students who maybe have this disease that it is cool to be on a Saturday afternoon and to go to, for example, the Michigan-Notre Dame game and not be obliterated? How do we form a community where it's a safe place for them to be sober? Well, we, number one, give them a place where they can be together. We, number two, show them a place where they can celebrate their recovery and have a fun time together. It's the same concept as a fraternity, basically. But you know, where they have a place of like-minded individuals coming together to celebrate their success. Because for these kids, it's not an option of going out and just having fun or maybe being hungover on Sunday morning. For these kids, it's life or death. But a lot of college campuses have a, you know, like work hard, play hard mentality. These kids don't have an option of that. Like, they can die if they go back out there. They don't necessarily have one more use of heroin in them. Kids are dying all over the state right now.
For the kinds of statistics that I was talking about at the beginning of this interview, Jen, how concerned do you believe we should all be about the meth problem in Michigan?
I think it's growing. I think it's growing. And I think, you know, the thing about it is heroin doesn't necessarily scream. It's prevalent in Ann Arbor, but it doesn't necessarily scream that you can be hugely academically successful. You know, it's definitely on our campus, but this meth thing, I mean, for me, when I first found it, I was like, I can do everything now. This is awesome, you know? And so I think we should be definitely concerned with it, because it's one of those drugs, too, that gets you hooked right away the first time. So these kids try it once. And now they can do all the partying they want to do, crease their four-day weekends to 5-6-day weekends, and be academically successful at the same time here in Michigan. We got a problem.
You're heading to Texas to continue your work with the Collegiate Recovery Program. What do you want to continue doing throughout your life because of your experience as a meth addict?
I think that this has been my journey. Like, I think that I was given this disease in order to do this work. Like, I wouldn't be as good at this work or have this opportunity if I hadn't gone through everything that I went through. And I learned a lot, you know, from making mistakes and from, you know, learning how to work with students that are 30 days sober and fresh on a campus. So now I get the opportunity to do it again. And I'm taking it kind of back to my home state. So this is the 360 about it all, because now I'm really taking it back to where I'm from. The other blessing about all this is I have been cleared by the Texas prison system to bring Alcoholics Anonymous back into the Texas prison system. I would not be sober today if I had not started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous while I was incarcerated. So I'm really honored to be able to do that on the weekends down there too. And that wouldn't be possible if I didn't move back. So I think there's kind of a 360 about it all too. If I didn't go through everything I went through, I wouldn't get to keep going back down there. So I think – and I think I have kind of a gift for working with college students. So I'm kind of excited about it.
And so back at it. Jen Servi, a substance abuse coordinator with Michigan Ability Partners in Ann Arbor, but heading back to Texas where she'll be working with the Collegiate Recovery Program and also now that we're here, helping incarcerated women with Alcoholics Anonymous as well. She stopped using meth and her life changed on May 3rd, 2006. Jen, thank you for sharing your story with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, as we enjoy summertime fishing season, we look at the history of fish stocking. Coming up in 15 minutes, this is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Democrats in the State House are calling for more state regulations on hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, in Michigan. Fracking releases oil and gas from deep underground by cracking open rock with a high-pressure mix of water, fine sand, and chemicals pumped into wells. The state has seen an influx of energy producers since companies began using this controversial process to extract natural gas. Democratic State Representative Sarah Roberts is a co-sponsor of this package of eight bills. She represents the 18th District from St. Clair Shores, and she joins us now. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's really a pleasure to join you today.
What is it that you want to accomplish with this package of bills?
First and foremost, we want to make sure that the chemicals used in the fracking process, that the drilling companies fully disclose which chemicals they are using. The EPA recently issued a study and determined that in the fracking process all across the country, you know, there are some 930 chemicals that are used in this process, and some of them, you know, are not so nice. So we just want to make sure that if there is an instance of drinking water contamination, soil contamination, or there have been examples in other states of like a methane gas explosion, and if we have our first responders going into these incidents, then we want to make sure we know what chemicals we're dealing with. Number two, fracking uses a lot of water. Currently, there are 52 active fracking permits in the state of Michigan, and 17 are pending. And based on the analysis that we've done, that's roughly 500 million gallons of our water. Now, a Canadian company, Encana Gas and Oil, has publicly proposed 500 new wells in Michigan in using up to 4 billion gallons of water. So we want to make sure these fracking operations are reporting the amount of water that they're using so that if there is, in fact, an adverse impact on our water resource, then we can take the appropriate action. Third, currently the public does not have an opportunity to weigh in on fracking operations with, say, a public hearing. So we give the ability for the public to call for that hearing and participate in the permit process to make sure that their voice is heard. We give some authority to local communities. We put together an advisory committee and we call for a study to look at the environmental and public health impacts, and then they will make recommendations to us if in fact, you know, the regulatory framework we have put together is not adequate.
So does that not happen now? Do individuals in a community not get a voice in whether or not a permit is granted?
They do not, not with fracking.
Fracking isn't new in Michigan, is it? I mean, they've been doing vertical drilling since the early 50s.
Yes, since 1952. And nationwide, they've been doing fracking for oil and gas since the 1940s. But the difference here is the new technology, which is the horizontal fracking. So instead of vertically going down 3,000 feet, we have drills that can go as far as 10,000 feet, and the actual horizontal drills can be, you know, thousands of feet long, and so that uses more land, more water, more chemicals.
I'm speaking with Democratic State Representative Sarah Roberts of the 18th District. She's co-sponsor of a package of bills introduced by Democrats in the State House looking for more state regulations on hydraulic fracturing, specifically, as we just heard from the representative, this newer horizontal drilling that uses more chemicals, more water, and more land. How do you respond, Representative, to those who say, look, we have this appetite for energy and we want to have it generated here at home so we're not dependent on what happens in the Middle East.
Well, certainly natural gas is a growing energy resource, and that's in part because the cost for natural gas has been low and continues to be low as we extract more natural gas. And we're not, you know, saying to the natural gas industry, we don't want you to do this. We just want to make sure that there's a common sense regulatory framework so that we make sure if anything, you know, bad happens, that we're able to, one, know the extent of what has happened, and we're able to hold them accountable to do the right thing. And, you know, we also have two other huge industries here in Michigan that rely heavily on our land and our water, and that's agriculture and tourism. And we need to make sure that those industries are protected as well so that they can continue to thrive, create, you know, have jobs and put money into the economy.
There are signatures, as we speak right now, being gathered for a proposal for the 2014 ballot to actually outlaw horizontal hydraulic fracking. Do you support a ban like that?
Well, at this time, we felt like the best approach was to put into a regulatory framework and study the issue and see what the outcomes of that are. But, of course, I support the citizens' right to petition, to go out there, talk to the public, and if they're able to, you know, gather enough signatures and get that issue on the ballot, I'll be very curious to see how the public weighs in on this issue.
So your feeling as someone who does care about the environment, clearly it's part of really who you are in Lansing, and the fact that you've helped to co-sponsor this package, you're not necessarily saying you'd like to see a ban on horizontal hydraulic fracking.
Yeah, what we're saying right now is there currently in state statute is no regulatory framework for fracking. And my understanding is at the federal level, fracking is exempt from the Clean Water Act. So we just want to make sure that as this industry moves forward, you know, we're making sure that it's being done right and that we're tracking, you know, the amount of water that is being used and making sure that there's full disclosure of the chemicals that are being used. And, of course, giving a voice to the citizens, which is paramount.
Representative Roberts, as a Democrat, I don't have to tell you, you're in the minority in the House. How likely do you feel it is these measures will get brought up in session?
Well, I'm hopeful because, again, these are really common sense pieces of legislation that we're asking for. We're not talking about raising permits. We're not about talking about shutting down operations. We're talking about disclosure of chemicals, reporting water use, increasing the setbacks of operations from schools and hospitals and daycare centers, you know, giving the public a voice. And so I look forward to, you know, reaching out and working in a bipartisan fashion to talk about this issue. And I think we should have this debate, and I think we should include the citizens in this debate. And that's exactly what we're going to do. I'm co-chair of the Great Lakes and Conservation Task Force. We're going to be having hearings across the state talking about a variety of issues that impact Great Lakes and conservation. And certainly fracking is going to be a part of that discussion.
Your co-sponsor, along with Representative Tom Cochran of Mason and Andy Shore of Lansing, have any of the three of you had discussions with the Republicans on this issue and on this package?
You know, we haven't had an opportunity yet. We worked very hard on these bills since January, and we finally, you know, came to some conclusion on the eight bills essentially the day that we went on break. So I look forward to reaching out to the other side of the aisle, which I plan on doing, and having a conversation about how we can move these bills forward.
Democratic State Representative Sarah Roberts, 18th District from St. Clair Shores. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And another environmental news. Here's something to think about the next time you pick up a fishing pole and cast into one of the Great Lakes. That fish you catch might have gotten there not courtesy of Mother Nature, but rather with some help from the Department of Natural Resources. This year alone, the DNR will stock about 19 million fish into the Great Lakes. Gary Whelan is with the State Department of Natural Resources, and he joins us now from Lansing. Gary, it seems kind of surprising that Mother Nature needs this much help to keep the Great Lakes stocked with fish. Why is it necessary?
Well, there's a number of factors. One is that we have a lot of human use of our waters, and lots of people like the fish, like to eat fish, and some of that is that we can't necessarily keep up with the demand for some fish species above and beyond what naturally we can reproduce. Some species are not at levels that we'd like them to be, where we feel that their populations are fully recovered, for example. Another reason is that perhaps a particular fish species is no longer present in a water body that it should be. A good example would be lake sturgeon, for example, that we're trying to rehabilitate across the state. And then to meet angler demand, the anglers want a certain number of certain types of fish. We do our very best to meet those demands. So you look at a broad range of reasons why the Great Lakes can't, in combination, the demand on the fish, the harvest pressure, and finally the habitat. And many of our habitats are not where we'd like them to be, or we no longer have spawning access to tributary streams. So a combination of habitat and harvest are the main reasons why we need to continue stocking fish.
Gary, this is nothing new, is it? Fish stocking goes way back in Michigan's history.
Yeah, fish stocking is the genesis of fisheries management in a lot of perspectives in all across the United States. Really, that started with the clear observation that most of our stocks were being heavily depleted by mostly commercial fisheries, but on the other side, very significant habitat degradation by roughly 1870.
All that lumbering?
Lumbering in particular. You had a combination of building dams and cutting off tributary streams, some of which legacies we live with today. And, of course, all the various industrialized pollutants, whether they were sawmill wastes. One story that's pretty interesting is that many of the commercial fishermen out of Manistique in northern Lake Michigan used to find their way home in foggy conditions by following the sawdust back to the port.
Wow.
So that gives you some idea just the amount of material that was being put into the Great Lakes. You can still find sawdust in the bottom in many harbor areas if you go looking for it enough. And those had really significant degradation effects on those waters and prevented fish for example, getting back to our spawning grounds. So the first fish stocking in Michigan was done in 1873 by the U.S. Fish Commission. It was actually Atlantic salmon, which is kind of interesting, was the first fish. We joined in soon thereafter, and a broad range of fish were brought in for many different reasons, most of which had to do with providing food fish to replace those that were being over-harvested. In particular, lake whitefish was the major targeted species, although they then moved on to other species, and so did the fish culturists at the time. But the people at the time, particularly our early fish commissioners, and one of our first ones was George Jerome, he clearly noted that not only was there wanton waste from the commercial fisheries, but also noted the degradation of our resources by the various commercial and industrial effects on our waters. I mean, it was well understood by 1873 that many of our areas were already pretty heavily degraded and heading in the wrong way. We have a long history of it. In fact, Michigan is our fisheries division is the second oldest institution, at least governmental institution, in the state of Michigan.
So in those years since it all began in 1873, what would you say would be some of the main success stories from fish stocking? And then on the other side of the coin, from the well-intentioned but caused big problems file, where were the oops moments?
Some of the big oops, we'll start with the oops ones first.
Okay.
We'll start with the bad and we'll go to the good.
All right.
From the oops perspective, there's no doubt that the introduction of common carp into our waters was one of the big mistakes that was ever made, perhaps in North America, but probably globally.
Hmm.
They have caused a lot of resource damage, common carp. Now, they're part of our systems. They're not going anywhere. It was a huge mistake. They were brought in really as part of the immigrants' wish to bring their food fishes with them, which is very, very common across the globe, is that people, as they migrate, want to bring whatever was familiar with them, whether it's starlings or European house sparrows or in this case, common carp,
okay,
and put them in there for food purposes. But they realized within 5 years that they had made a very big mistake, and that was in the 1880s that they went ahead to introduce common carp into Michigan. And we had a carp hatchery. Down in the southwest part of the state. So
hard to believe.
Yeah, hard to believe. It wasn't one of our glorious moments. That was one that certainly we would say that I wish we wouldn't have done that one. On the positive side, you really have to start thinking about things like, you know, our Great Lakes waters were an ecological disaster zone in the early 1960s. Sea lamprey had come in along with alewives. Sea lamprey, along with commercial fishing and habitat loss, really reduced big predators in the system.
Yeah.
To a low, low level. Without big predators around, alewives absolutely exploded. And back in the 60s, there's lots of photos, and I have dim memories of, coastlines filled with with alewives washed up on the beaches.
As do I. Those of us who grew up in Michigan in the 60s, even if you hadn't seen an alewife, you knew alewives were a big problem with our Great Lakes.
Right. Well, to redress that problem, Howard Tanner and Wayne Toedy, who were both fisheries leadership at the time, in leadership positions, decided to look around for predators that could redress the balance and try to use all that standing stock of fish for something, in this case, sport fish. And the introduction of both coho and Chinook salmon have certainly given the opportunity and control of alewives, which have led to rehabilitation of lake trout stocks.
So take that, alewives.
Yeah, take that. Finally got rid of that one. But on the other side, other species, walleye, for example, in Saginaw Bay, walleye were practically non-existent in the 1970s. We made a very aggressive stocking program and reintroduced walleyes into Saginaw Bay, and they are, you know, they're incredibly abundant up the entire Lake Huron coast. The same goes for other areas of the state for walleye. And then we're slowly working our way into Lake Sturgeon rehabilitation. And certainly if you look at our many fisheries around our state that people hold near and dear, many of our trout fisheries and inland trout fisheries were all established because of fish stocking many a long, long time ago. And what people need to recognize that trout are not native to most of our waters, particularly inland waters. Everybody thinks that brook trout was native to the southern peninsula, and that's really not the case except for a few select waters around the tip of the mitt. But most of that water was occupied by Arctic grayling that were there in very large number, were extirpated out of all of our waters by the mid-1930s. And certainly from the Osabo, Manistee, and Muskegon region by about 1900, they were pretty much gone, a combination of incredible logging practices that we would consider to be horrific today, which would be, you know, driving logs down the stream, ripping out the banks, tearing apart their habitat, and then they're extremely vulnerable to harvest, and they would just harvest them by the garbage pails, well, not garbage pails, but by barrels at the time, and ship them out for food.
Wow.
That fish could not tolerate that sort of abuse and disappeared, but what replaced it, of course, was brook trout. We stocked brook trout in very soon. Brown trout came in behind them. To a certain extent, steelhead did too. And replaced those species, and frankly, are naturalized and are what we would consider a sort of a substitute species for what was there historically and provided tremendous trout fishery today.
Gary Whelan, how do you respond to those who view fish stocking as toying and tweaking with the natural balance of the Great Lakes?
Well, that's an interesting concept. You know, I've certainly heard that by many. And the reality is that humans have been tinkering with that system for a couple hundred years now. In one way or the other, and to think of the system as, you know, it will be some natural balance in some way without any sort of human intervention is sort of not considering that humans are part of the system. And, you know, we have to do what's best both for the system and, you know, frankly, for what our citizens want, because we work to protect the public trust resources and we hold them in trust for the citizens of the state. You know, the citizens have demands that they wish to have on that, and they can't be fulfilled by just simply allowing the system to go to some equilibrium point that we certainly won't have any control over, any understanding of. And hatcheries are part of the toolbox, as I mentioned before. In combination with regulations, in combination with habitat improvement, rehabilitation, and protection are the key components to allowing us to provide a economically beneficial and ecologically sustainable system for our citizens and visitors to our fine state.
Gary Whelan giving us something to think about the next time you take out a fishing rod. He's with the state DNR, and he joined us from Lansing. Thank you, Gary, so much.
You're welcome. Have yourself a great afternoon.
And thanks to those of you who have joined us on Twitter. We love connecting with you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.